service is delivered by people. And if people are the product, then you got to have a strong culture, you know, to get an engaged workforce to take care of customers. You take care of customers, they give you more stuff to do and revenue rains from the sky. So my secret sauce is my people, building a strong culture, getting an engaged workforce.
Hello there and welcome back to the My Future Business Show. It is wonderful to be back with you after a week or so break with family, having a holiday away. You know, that time to refresh and recuperate always makes a big difference. Now on today's show, I have the pleasure of welcoming speaker, consultant, and three times best-selling book author, Adam Coffey. Welcome to the show, Adam.
Hey, Rick. It's good to be here. Hello to all your listeners out there.
Yes, thank you again for joining us. Now, you and I, we're going to be talking about many things, but primarily about your newest best-selling book called Empire Builder, The Road to a Billion. But before we do that, Adam, what we normally do is we go through a little bit of the cursory stuff and learn a little bit more about you, where you live and all that sort of stuff. So where are you calling in from today?
I am just outside of Dallas, Texas, in the United States. I love being in the Dallas area. I'm 2.5 hours by flight to anywhere in North America, direct flight, Dallas, big airport, and I've got a direct flight to every major city on the planet. So it's my hub,
It's the hub. Yeah, absolutely. And combine that with the wonders of technology, and you know, we're literally just a click or a flight away, aren't we?
We really are. And so, and you know what? I'm kind of old school, so I love doing Zoom. Don't have any problem. It's the right tool for many occasions. But there are times where you just need to get on a plane. You need to sit across from somebody. So I like that accessibility to an airport.
There's something different about bumping shoulders with people, isn't there, at an event or something like that?
I think you get a better look at the authentic person. You know, if you're doing a negotiation, you know, sitting across, understanding, reading body language sometimes is hard to do on Zoom, any kind of video conference. So. I think there are just some times where you need to be in the same room for sure.
So tell me, what do you like about the place where you live and what's one of the landmarks that people should get to know if they've never been there before?
Well, so Dallas, you know, Dallas, Texas, boy, you know, if you go back just the history of the United States, you know, this area was known for a couple of different things. Obviously, Texas was known for oil. So we're one of the oil capitals, you know, of the world. And, but we're also known for cattle. And so, you know, Fort Worth, you have Dallas, Fort Worth, these two sister cities. And, you know, Dallas was the hub of business and Fort Worth was the hub of cattle. And so, you know, millions of heads of cattle would roll through the Fort Worth stockyards every year, you know, on their way. You know, the farmers would bring them in and off they'd go, you know, to serve, you know, customers all around the world. So, you know, those are kind of the two things we're known for. Of course, you know, a bad thing we're known for probably is the, President John F. Kennedy was assassinated.
Oh, yes.
We just had the anniversary just recently. And I remember the first time I was down in the area, I didn't go down there looking for that area. I happened to just be driving in downtown Dallas. And boy, it was amazing. I looked around. I'm like, my God, I'm here. That's the grand.
This is the spot.
That's the spot. And I was taken back by how small an area it actually was. And how the motorcade was literally about 200 yards from going under a bridge and making a right-hand turn and being out of danger. So just a small little area, you know, and of course we've all seen that on TV, you know, over the course of our lives. And it's like to be able to just recognize it instantly as, that's where I am. You know, so that was one of the things. Of course, Texas also known for Houston, you know, Houston Control for
the... Course.
You know, all of the different space missions that have been out there. So, you know, the Alamo, you know, the place.
And the list goes on, doesn't it?
It does. And, you know, Texas is the only state in the United States that was actually an independent country once upon a time. And so the Republic of Texas fought for and won its independence from Mexico and then joined the Union. And so, you know, Hey, I'm a proud Texan. You know,
a bit of a historian by the sounds of things.
You know, I love history. Always have.
Yeah, so absolutely. Thank you so very much for sharing it. I would love to learn a little bit about the things that you enjoy doing. Do you have any hobbies or sports that you like to get involved with?
So I am a sports nut because of my age. I'm 59, which means I grew up in an era when there was five channels on the television. There wasn't hundreds of channels. There was no internet. There were no video games. And so we played sports. You know, you get up every day.
Imagine that. Outside,
you know, and yet you're playing sports. So I was a sports nut for sure. I'm a pilot. You know, I don't know if you're seeing my video, but, you know, that's a picture
yes.
of me flying yes. a World War II P-51 Mustang.
Oh, wow.
Doing a barrel roll. So I'm flying upside down, holding a GoPro in one hand as I'm flipping around.
And, multi-skilled.
Yeah. So and enjoy being a pilot, you know, love travel, love to eat, you know. So yeah, I think all of my trips, if I think about what's my favorite places on the planet to go, I think my stomach leads the way to answer that question.
That's great. I love it. Now, what do you like? What's your food of choice?
You know, I'll go back to my age. You know, there was no FedEx when I was growing up. And so I grew up in a landlocked area, you know, the Midwestern United States. And so I was a beef, meat and potatoes guy. And yes, so sir. There was no such thing as fresh seafood. There was no seafood anywhere close to us. So you know, I was more of a meat and potatoes guy. So if I'm out traveling, it's like, I love Italy. I love Germany, you know, as an example, but these are, you know, it's palate driven. And so,
yes, yes.
You know, and it's funny too. So in Australia, the head of the cattle bureau or the head of the cattle world, I don't remember what his title is. His name's Adam Coffee.
And are so, you kidding me?
No. And there's another little Adam Coffee tidbit is, so I guess in Australia, everybody loves their beef too, huh?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Absolutely. That's for sure and certain. Now, you were talking a little bit about going back in time, I guess, when we were growing up as children. What did you recall about your childhood? For me, for example, the rule was that you didn't have to be at home until the streetlights came on. Did you have that sort of a lifestyle when you were growing up?
Yeah, and I'll tell you, just to give you a little more color. So I grew up in an Irish Roman Catholic family. And what that means, besides we like to drink as adults, it means that there's a bunch of us. And so I was number 9 out of 10 kids. We were not the biggest family in the neighborhood. There was one family that had 14 kids. And so there was like a million kids, you know, on our street. And so you could have, you know, whatever was in season, you know, for a sport wise, it's like we play sports. But I tell people I was raised by the neighborhood because you'd pretty much leave at dawn and, you know, lunch was on the go at whoever's house you might have been near or at, you know, and you would come home. You know, come home when the streetlights go on. That's a good time to show back up for dinner. And you literally entertained yourself all day long.
Absolutely. You drank out of a hose. And, you know, if you came home before the sun, before the lights came on, you had chores to do. So you never did you?
Yes, right. And course, you know, back then, my first job, I was a paper boy. I delivered papers. I was about 12 years old. Can't do that in today's world, but back then you could. And yeah, I would rake leaves and shovel snow and, you know, cut grass in the summer. I was like, I was a pretty industrious, you know, I had a good, strong work ethic as a little kid. You know, that's how
I was going to ask you about your first entrepreneurial experience. You know, they're always in those formative years, you know, we not only do things like that, but sometimes there's people around us that are kind of nudging us that way. Did you have anybody in those early years encouraging you to, you know, get involved with those types of things? Who was around you at that time?
You know, so I think that's just what kids did. You know, we all had kind of, it's like we had a need for money. You know, if we wanted to get money, you know, our parents all grew up in the Depression era. You know, and I remember, you know, I actually grew up in an affluent family. But, you know, when I was getting close to 16, you know, it's time to buy my first car. You know, my dad was like, well, I'm not buying you a car. What are you going to do? And I went and got a job, you know, and it's like when it was time for college, you know, my dad, you know, was, hey, I joined the Navy. I did Navy ROTC at Notre Dame. What are you going to do? It's like, you know, it's like everything. You know, my dad fostered a work ethic of if you want something in life, you have to work for it. And how are you going to be the solution to your own problem, you know, and your own needs? And so I would say that I grew up very self-sufficient, recognizing that if I had a want, I had to go earn, you know, I had to I had to bridge that gap. And so, you know, that
kind
that
of like the self-fulfilling prophecy in many ways, isn't it? Now,
yeah, today everybody wants to be a TikTok star and a social media influencer. I don't want to work for a living, you know, but hey, when your toilet's clogged up, a plumber, you know, some guy in a truck needs to come and make it work. you know, the work ethic is definitely different. But I think I was pretty grounded by my parents growing up and just the era.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, that, I don't know if I'm going to get this right, Adam, but, you know, hard times create soft people and soft times create hard people. I think, you know, we're going through that cyclical moment in time where our children, depending on how we're, I guess, bringing them up and parenting them. I guess my question is that how important is parenting to, you know, help them become the people that they need to become to not only survive but thrive in the future?
Well, it's really everything, in my opinion. And I look at the struggles going on here in the U.S. in my own country, and,
yep.
you know, a lack of accountability. And, you know, our cities are in some level of decay, you know, in my opinion. And, you know, and it, everything goes back to strong, you know, I'll call it moral character and mm-hmm. family values and areas where those values are still high seem to be doing better than areas that are not. But this is really a global phenomenon. It's not just a U.S. phenomenon. You know,
where absolutely.
We're seeing all kinds of just unrest in general globally. And, you know, I see it in France. I see it in the U.K. You know, it's like it's a global issue. It's not just a U.S. issue. But definitely, I want to be present for my own kids. And you know, when I was climbing the corporate ladder and an executive at GE, you know, I'll be honest with you, I was chasing title and money, and I wasn't the best dad, you know, in the world. But I recognized that at some point and said, you know, I got to be better. I got to be present, you know. And now I'll tell you, my business pursuits, you know, if my daughter has a recital at school, I don't care what's going on anywhere else in the world, I'll be there. You know, it's like, I'm going to be present. I'm going to make sure that I'm there for her. And I'm grounding her with the same kind of, you know, moral character and values that I had when I was growing up. So
there are certainly lots of commonalities worldwide. You know, there's lots of corporate ladder climbers that suddenly come to the realization that life is not a dress rehearsal and that every moment of time that you have to spend with your children is precious, isn't it?
Well, and it's the one thing in life we can't buy. No matter how wealthy we are, we can't buy time.
Yeah.
And so we have to make the best use of it. And, you know, I encounter so many executives who are so busy being busy that yep. they're not actually living. They're not actually running their companies. They're just busy being busy, and they're running from one fire to another. So I think we all need to be better at how we manage time. Great study that I read not too long ago from Harvard Business Review. And it was a study done about how successful people allocate and manage their time. And it was a study of CEOs, successful CEOs. It wasn't about how they became successful. It was strictly about how they managed time. And it was pretty shocking to read that and reflect on how I live my own life. And, you know, you'd be amazed that successful people, it's not about working more. It's about working smarter and having a bigger impact, you know, in a shorter amount of time. And and most very successful people or ultra successful people actually block, you know, good sections of their calendar up to 25% of their time for just alone time, for introspective thinking and being strategic and planning and responding. And, you know, how many of us just get stuck in a day where we go meeting to meeting to meeting to meeting and we don't have any breaks to think or respond? You know, we're just too busy being busy. So I'm very mindful of that. I start my day early every day. I'm up at 4 a.m. And that time between 4 and 6:30, that's when all my books are written. That's when I do, you know, my strategic thinking, my planning, and it's my quiet time. And if I don't get that quiet time, my day's off, you know, my day's off. And then the world wakes up about 6:30, and by 7, my calendar kicks in.
And then it kicks in and standard day starts to happen for everybody else. I wonder, you know, as a father myself, I often think about legacy. I also think about my children and what type of lessons and disciplines and things like that I want to impart upon them. What have you got in mind for your children? What do you do? What's important for your family, do you think?
Well, you know, so I don't mind saying I believe in God. I believe in country and in service. You know, I'm a very wealthy guy. I make time for my family, but I also give back to the community. I volunteer my time at my daughter's school. I volunteer my time. I'm the planning and zoning commissioner for the town I live in, you know, voluntary. So I give of my time. I give of my money. You talk about my three books. I donate 100% of my royalties to charity. I always have. And so I believe, you know, that the more successful we are in life, the more required of us to give back to humanity. So that's the kind of legacy I try to instill in my kids.
So when you get to look at your own life, you know, there's a bucket list, I have at least. Do you have a bucket list, and what's on it? What would you like to do?
You know, I don't have a formal bucket list, but I can tell you, boy, if I just look back at my life, man, you know, I am Irish. So when I die, prop me up in the corner and have a party. You know, it's like, you know, hey, you know, I was a soldier, you know, in the United States Army. I'm a pilot. Yeah. I was an engineer. I was a CEO. I'm a number one best-selling author. You know, it's like any one of my experiences in life, you know, for some people would be their life's work. You know, I was a really good engineer. Well, you know, but then I was a really good CEO, and I'm a best-selling author, and I'm a pilot, and, you know, I'm a soldier, a veteran. And it's like, you know, so I think, you know, I've accomplished a lot. So when I think about the future, I first, you know, wake up every day and I say, thank you. You know, thank you, Lord. You know, it's like I've lived a great life. You know, whenever it's time for me to go, you know, nobody cry for me. I had a great run. You know, I really enjoyed my time here. So I'm really mindful that I don't know when my last day is. And so therefore, I got to make the most of each day. So I don't want to leave any cards on the table unplayed. So I take, you know, I'm not afraid to take a risk, you know, calculated risk, you know, in business, you know, or in life. But I'm having fun. I enjoy yes. every day.
Yeah. And I think this is what makes the My Future Business Show, I guess, fundamentally different than most other business-focused podcasts, is that we dig a little bit deeper. We look at the lifestyles. We look at the values and the things like that that are important to you. So I really do appreciate that.
Hey, you've taken me down rabbit holes, you know, that 150 or more other podcasts have never gone down. So I think my followers in the world and social media are going to enjoy this one.
Yeah, fantastic. Now tell me, as a book author yourself, do you find yourself writing in the morning or in the afternoon, or do you do it when you're, say, having a, I guess, you know, quote unquote, formal break away from work?
So as I told you, I think between the hours of 4 and 6:30 is when most of my books were written. And if I take this last one, Empire Builder, it actually started as a seminar. So I created a 350 slide PowerPoint seminar. And I wrote that, took about 6 months. And then I gave it, you know, I gave it before a live audience of 350 people. It was 2 days here in Dallas. People came from all over the country, you know, all over the world. Mm-hmm. And I think it was 27 countries, 30 countries, people came in. And I then spent 2 days lecturing and you know, giving this material called Empire Builder. And as soon as I was done and everybody left town and I recovered, because I put a lot into my seminars, and so I was pretty drained. But as soon as I recovered, I immediately picked up, call it the proverbial pen, and went from seminar to book. And yep. So, you know, it's like it started life as a seminar, as all of my books did. They started life as college lectures, you know, or you know, teachings, you know, and then I perfected that as a lecture format, came into an outline, and ultimately it became a book. And there's a very prescriptive formula for business books. And I'm sure it has to do with profitability for printers and publishers, but, you know, it's kind of, you know, it's 40,000 words. It's 4 sections. It's 3 chapters per section. You know, it's going to come in, you know, there's an introduction, there's an out, you know, to each of these sections, you know, and then there's a wrap up for the book. If you can do that in 40,000 words, it's going to be 240 pages, 250 pages. And then when you charge, you know, based on the cost of a book to produce, you know, it builds in the right profit margin. You know, you can't charge more than $29 for that hardcover. So if you write an 80,000 word book, it costs twice as much to produce. The profit margins are thinner. So the publishing world has this very prescriptive size for business book. All of my books can be read, you know, I would say that the typical average reader, you know, somewhere between 5-6 hours or so, you know, 40,000 words, you know, it was a 350 page 2 day seminar. Now it's a 5 hour read. You know, and
yeah, it's amazing. I was looking at your work with MBA candidates and your speaking arrangements, and lots of people that I speak to have a fear of public speaking. How do you go in that sort of environment?
Well, first, I would like to reach out to all of my grade school teachers. If you're still living and listening to this podcast, you know, you remember how I was that class clown and the guy you couldn't get to shut up? Well, guess what? You know, my mouth got me somewhere, you know, as a result of that. So I would say public speaking is something that we can learn, but there are people who have a real genuine fear of it. I never had a fear of talking to people. I can only remember one time where I got up to give a speech where I was so nervous, I thought I might pass out. And it actually, I have it on video, and it actually was a really good speech. It wound up going over really well. But, you know, so I think, you know, when I was, you know, younger years learning, you know, so here's a tip. If you want to learn public speaking, go to church. Uh-huh. You know, there's good. Yeah, you know, I was in Alabama, you know, at the time. It's like, I remember going to a Baptist, you know, a Southern Baptist, see a Southern Baptist preacher preach for about 3 hours when it's 100 degrees outside and there's no air conditioning in the little church, and listen to the, and they got a sword in their hand, yes, that weighs 300 pounds, and they're whipping it around. And they're going crazy. It's like, boy, you know, who does public speaking? Pastors do.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it's like, you know, so there's different ways that people learn. I mean, you can join clubs like Toastmasters, you know, but practice makes perfect. So I'll tell you this. I learned this from Jack Welch. I learned this at GE. For every minute of public speaking, you should spend an hour practicing. Uh-huh. You know, every minute. So you're going to give a 15-minute speech. You want to nail it? That's 15 hours.
Yep.
You know, you want to know your material inside and out. You know, I'm talking. There were plenty. I don't have to do this anymore. I'm very natural at it now. But I used to. You know, literally, you know, I'd be in a room, you know, and I would practice my speech and I'd talk to myself in the mirror. And, you know, it's like I have a PowerPoint deck. What are the 3 points I'm going to make on each slide? And you know what? I'm never going to memorize the whole thing the same way every time. And I don't sit there with notes at a podium. That's too boring. I want to wander around. And so I train myself to, you know, just go through this methodology of, you know, what are the 3 points I'm going to make on each slide? If I can just get those, maybe there was 4 or 5, but if I can get 3 nailed each time, you know, I'm in pretty good shape. And so if you listen to me give the same speech 10 times, each one will be slightly different, but 90% of it will be covered each time. So I like being natural. I don't like, you know, standing at a podium and being fixed. And so I think if you practice, you can learn how to do this. You can conquer that fear. You look for opportunities where you can practice and do it in a public environment where maybe it's not as impactful, or it doesn't matter to your life as much, so that when you do get that big speech, finally, you're prepared, you're ready. And then it's like anything else we do in life. If you have repetitions, then, you know, we train, you know, soldiers, we train. We train because when the real thing happens, you can't think, you have to react. Yeah. And so you fall back to your training. You're a pilot, you have an emergency in the air, you know, it's like you go back to your training. Where's my checklist? What do I do in this particular case? And you're very calm, you know, about how you approach it. So I would say, if you want to conquer that fear, watch others, go to church, and then practice.
That's fantastic.
Practice and
I love it.
Seek out opportunities.
Yeah. Thank you very, very much for the feedback, Adam. Really enjoying the call. Now, you are an amazing example of what a human being can achieve in their life if they were to want to do it. Now, it leads me to think, you've talked about the mechanics of, you know, being able to react in hot situations, let's call them, through your discipline and your training in the army. But what about the mindset? Do you ever have days where you think to yourself, I can't be bothered, let's say, for example, getting out of bed? What do you do to motivate yourself and kick into the day? Do you ever have those days?
Oh, sure. You know, and I think, you know, I find in my work with entrepreneurs that this is probably one of the areas that I think stifles growth and creativity amongst people. As we get into a rut, we get complacent. There's no one, you know, if I'm not performing in my job as a CEO and I have a board of directors, I'm going to get fired. Yeah. And so not acting has consequences. When I'm a business owner, if I don't have a board, there's no one to hold me accountable. And so mediocrity is okay. It's acceptable. And if I don't feel good today, I can mail it in. And so I would say that, you know, the fact that most of my career I've had bosses who could fire me, and I was motivated to want to succeed and climb a corporate ladder, or I care about people. I want to be a good steward to my to my employees. Yep. And so it's like I have to lead by example. I'm a servant leader. I learned that in the military, and I lead by example. And so I don't get to have bad days, and I always tell my, I think it's in one of my books. I tell, probably in Empire Builder, the last book, I tell people, look, in a company, my product is people, right? So I've run service companies. Yep. You can't store service in a box. You can't put it on a shelf. When someone's washing machine breaks or CAT scanner breaks, I can't take a box of service down, sprinkle it, and then, throw some Done. Water on it, magically starts working. My product's people. Yep. I'm in a people business, and so service is delivered by people. And if people are the product, then you got to have a strong culture, to get an engaged workforce to take care of customers. You take care of customers, they give you more stuff to do, and revenue rains from the sky. So my secret sauce is my people, building a strong culture, getting an engaged workforce. And the bottom line is, I always say to my leadership team, you are managing our product. Our product is our people. You don't get to have a bad day. You don't get to take your frustrations out on your people. And I can tell you, as a CEO for 21 years, I fired many people. I had to make tough decisions. I had to make tough calls. I was in many a bad situation. Never in 21 years has any employee ever heard me give an ass chewing to anybody ever. It's counterproductive. Mm-hmm. I'm a very even keeled person. I have this one weird trait. So I've had to fire many people in my career as a CEO, and the people that I've let go, I've did it in such a manner with dignity that, for those people, and I'm helpful to those people, afterward, that, those people still follow me on social media. They still like things I post. And, there are times where we need to transition people, and how we treat people really matters. And so, I tell people, you don't get to have those bad days. So when you wake up and you're feeling like you're not on your A game, well, there's somebody out there who's dying. There's somebody out there who's, laying in a gutter that's homeless. And, you've got an opportunity, and what you choose to do with it, matters. And so I motivate myself. I don't get to have bad days.
I listened to this, and I think it's a really great segue into the idea of leadership, because obviously as a leader, you have to show those behaviors. You have to be consistent. Now, it makes me think about your time in the U.S. Army, because I know that you talk a lot about discipline and leadership. Tell us a little bit about your time serving and how discipline and leadership grew from there.
Well, sure. So, keep in mind, too, I wasn't a general, right? I was a CEO later in life. Mm-hmm. After high school, I'm a 17-year-old young person who just graduated from high school. I leave home with $150 in a backpack, a duffel bag, and I go in the U.S. Army as a private, Private E1. I am the lowest form of life. I am so low on the totem pole that when I look up, I see bubblegum on the bottom of somebody's shoe. That's how low of a starting point that I started in my career. And so I learned, very quickly how to shut up, follow direction, and, work as part of a team and blend into the woodwork and not stand out. But again, because I started at the bottom and I worked my way up, from there, so from leaving home at 17, private in the United States Army, the military gave me a technical education that, frankly, served me very well. And I worked on classified air defense forward area radar systems. And so I was a smart kid, had very high aptitude, just didn't want to go to college. Yeah, yeah. I didn't feel like going to college was the right thing for me. I wanted to go into the service. My dad served. He was in the Navy. He was a Navy officer. Served in the Korean War. My grandfather served in World War II. My family's been fighting battles since the Civil War, essentially. Mm-hmm. And so I had this, predetermined destination in mind that I would go in the service. And I chose the Army. I wasn't a great swimmer. I didn't want to be in the Navy and be on a boat. That was one. And two was, the Army had the best technical training that they would guarantee. And I had really high technical aptitude scores. And so I was able to go to school at NASA and learn how to repair forward area radar systems. And that led to a career in engineering. Right. And, you know, engineering made me a meticulous planner. But what I learned in the military was, you know, really, I mean, I started at the bottom. I worked my way up. You know, I was Soldier of the Year in 1984. And, you know, that's how old I am. You know, Ronald Reagan's president, Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall. I mean, it's like this stuff's going on in real time. That's, you know, that's my life. Wow. And, you know, so it was such, I tell people, if I wasn't there as a young man 40, you know, some odd years ago, I never achieved what I achieved in life. It was the foundation that built my entire life and career on, was learning, you know, to be a servant leader. You know, I was a non-commissioned officer, I was a sergeant, and, you know, I learned how to take orders. I learned how to, you know, how to get any mission done in any set of circumstances possible. You know, and it's like failure is just not an option. I'm gonna power through this. What's the worst thing that can happen? I can get killed. Well, if God wants me, he knows where to find me. So be it. So I was invincible as a young kid, and I did my job, and I learned how to do my job. And when I got out of the service, I remember my first job, I had none of the qualifications for which they were seeking. But the hiring manager was an ex-Army captain, and he looked at me and he said, you know, Sergeant, you were the Soldier of the Year. I know what that means.
Yes.
I can teach you, you know, I can teach you anything. You know, you've got the aptitude for it. And I know you'll show up to work on time. So he gave me a job anyway.
Yeah, there you go.
That's like it. So it started my technical career. You know, I became an engineer. I was a really, really good engineer. And that start came because a captain, you know, a former captain, saw this, you know, young buck sergeant getting out of the service and said, I know these awards you have. I know what you've done. I know the kind of person you are. You know, I want you on my team. And so I didn't get the job I applied for. I got another job. And then within about 6 months, I was then, you know, qualified and got the job I originally
went for.
But, you know, the guy made a hole because he knew. You know,
that's the sort of community, isn't it? It's like, yeah, you know, the inside rail.
At GE, I got involved in the junior military officer, you know, recruiting program. So I would go down to San Diego, and when naval officers were getting out, transitioning, you know, or Marine officers, I'd be interviewing them and talking to them about the merits of working in the GE, you know, leadership and management training programs. And so, you know, there is a community there. It's like, you know, people who are athletes as a kid make really good business people because they don't like to lose. You know, they're competitive, and they know how to play as part of a team. And military, they know how to play as part of a team. You know, they can face long odds and know that they got to do their job, and they're gonna succeed regardless. You know, they can't stop. You can't quit. And so I think some of these attributes kind of gave me what I'll call the drive and the, you know, to be successful later on in life as an executive, you know, whether it's at GE or as a CEO outside of GE. And so I think, but it all goes back to that fundamental beginning, young man, you know, like young boy learns how to become a man, learns how to function as part of a team, and learns how failure is not an option. And then starts climbing the ladder from there.
I just think, you know, this is why, you know, we talk about those formative years and everything that's happened thus far. You know, given what you've said to and shared with the My Future Business audience, Adam, it must have been very easy to write your books. Tell us a little bit about that journey.
Yeah, you know, my first book, which came out in February of 2019, so I'm coming up on 5 years for that book. It's called The Private Equity Playbook, and it was number one this morning. And so 5 years after I wrote it, it's a cult classic, and private equity firms buy it by the case and hand it out on college campuses when they're recruiting interns or recruiting associates. And it's been helpful to business owners and to private equity industry folks alike. And it was to take a very complex subject and to try to find, you know, a way to explain it to a plumber in a truck. And, you know, a small business owner, you know, here's what private equity is, here's how it works, and here's why you should care, because they're buying 50% of the companies sold on the planet because there's now $6 trillion in assets under management. It's like, you know, you can't go through a day without encountering a logo of a company owned by private equity. And so, it's become central to being an entrepreneur. It's created the world's market that entrepreneurs enjoy when they sell a company. Even if they don't sell it to private equity, the multiples being paid and the value being paid relates to this thing called private equity. Yep. So the book started, to answer your question, I was walking with my wife, and I was walking with our, we were walking our dogs. And I had been talking about writing a book for a number of years. Like virtually everybody on the planet says, there's a book in me somewhere. Yeah. And I knew there was a transition coming eventually. I wanted to stop being a CEO, and my wife kind of encouraged me, and she said, you know, you should write that book. You know, it's time to write that book. And I just finally said, you know what, you're right. It's time to write that book. And so the motivation was, I had been teaching at UCLA in the executive MBA program for a number of years, not full-time courses. I wasn't a professor, mm-hmm. adjunct professor or anything. I was a CEO, but I was a guest speaker, guest lecturer. I would come talk to cohorts of executive MBAs. Been doing that for a while, and I really enjoyed giving back. And I think you know, doing that for Professor Ullman, if you're out there, hello, John. And I still work with him to this day. But I mean, that really kind of fueled the fire of, I want to give back. I want to teach the next generation of people about this thing called private equity. You hear about private equity on the news, it's always negative. There's never good stories about private equity. It's always bad. That's the way the news is. And you talk to entrepreneurs, and some had good experiences, some had bad when they sold their company. And it's because nobody understood. To this day, if I have a room with 500 people in it, and they're all executives or business owners or entrepreneurs who've got successful businesses, if I give a basic 10-question quiz on private equity that's multiple choice, I guarantee you 90% of the room fails. And I'm not asking trick questions. I'm asking basic questions. And I just did this in September with a room filled with people. 90% of the room fails. You know, and I've only had one person in my entire life, you know, of doing this who scored 10 out of 10. And she told me she read my book the night before, and because all 10 answers are in my book, and she had an eidetic memory, and, you know, so she remembered everything, you know, but most people just don't, you know, they've heard the term, they have almost no working understanding of what private equity is or how it functions or why they should care. Yeah. You know, private equity is the world's largest source of non-bank lending. Private equity is the world's largest buyer of companies. You know, if it was a country, it would have the third largest GDP on the planet. Wow. I mean, this is an economic force to be reckoned with, and it has made the market for people to sell companies. And so entrepreneurs need to have a very good working understanding of how private equity works, how it's structured, what it needs, so that you can learn how to feed it what it wants and take from it what you need, which is equity, you know, debt, wealth creation, et cetera. And so, you know, I wrote that book to educate a generation about what private, I was a little upset actually, you know, hearing all the negative stories about private equity. I'm like, this is not my experience. You know, I'm building companies with thousands of employees. We are hiring people. We are taking good care of people. I'm a servant leader. I've got great cultures, and we're making a lot of money. And so I, you know, 20 years ago when I was doing this, I was a maverick. You know, I was proving to the world that you could make money for shareholders and take care of people. And you could do both things simultaneously. They were not mutually exclusive. So my focus was trying to spread a different gospel, you know, according to my own truth about what private equity was and how it works. And you know what? There's thousands of firms out there, 6,000 plus firms. There's good, bad, and ugly in any industry. So you know, I won't tell you they're all good because they're not. You know, but we as entrepreneurs need to know the difference and need to know how to understand if we're selling our company, who we should partner with, and how to figure out who's a good one, who's a bad one, and who meets our own needs and aligns with our goals and objectives. And so I would say that's where that first book came from. It came from a walk, walking the dog with my wife. I'm to write that book, honey, you're right. You know, I'm not going to be a CEO forever. And this book is going to be my pivot point. I'm going to publish that book, and I'm going to use that as a pivot to start my consulting career. And what happened was I sold the company I was running in January. The book came out in February. The buyer of my company was a partner who had worked with me in another company, previous adventure. Yep. In large part, they paid the price they did, and they bought the company because I was there. And so I agreed to stay. Mm-hmm. And so 2 years later, my second book came out, The Exit Strategy Playbook, and that was the pivot. You know, the book came out in September, you know, October, whenever it was, I think it was September, and then I rotated out of the CEO seat in November. And so, you know, I delayed, you know, waited for the second book. At this point, I'm committed. I will write a book every 2 years. After I write a book, I take a year off, you know, and then I'll come back at it and produce another one. So my plan is to write at least five. I'm three in. I have two more outlines fully populated, you know, for two more books. And so there's going to be at least five. Wow. And as long as I'm healthy and having fun, you know, I'm sure there'll be more than that. So
yeah, well, you're doing very well. You certainly on your way down the path. Now, tell us a little bit about the contents of Empire Builder, The Road to a Billion. This looks fascinating.
So, you know, I bought 58 companies in my career. And I had billions in exits, you know, building my companies, my three companies for nine different private equity firms. And, you know, there's some statistics, you know, that I'll share with you. Here in the United States, there's 33 million small businesses. They employ 50% of the country's workforce. They represent 99.9% of all companies on the planet. But yet, even given, or I'm sorry, 99.9% of the companies in this country, in spite of the fact that there's 33 million of them, only 7% ever get to $1 million in revenue. And only 4% of the 7% get to $10 million in revenue. And there's only 3,000 companies in the entire planet that have $1 billion in revenue. 2,000 are public, 1,000 are private. And so if you think about business, and 33 million is just the U.S. I don't have a global statistic, mm-hmm. but if 33 million is the U.S., you have to imagine it's hundreds of millions of companies out there. Yep. And very few get to $1 million in revenue. It's like, why is success so hard?
Elusive.
And so I studied it. I thought about it. You know, I incorporated it because I'm working with small entrepreneurs now, too. You know, I wanted to write a book that guided people through creating, you know, from scratch and going all the way to $1 billion. And I wanted to break it down into the different sizes and the different activities. And so, you know, Empire Builder starts at zero. You know, I'm starting with an idea, you know, and so how do I even focus an idea? And I talk about needs versus wants. I want people to focus on needs. The economies of all of our countries are very cyclical. There's a lot of ups and downs. There's wars going on in places, mm-hmm. planes flying into buildings. It's just a volatile place. Yep. And if I build a, you know, I want a new truck. I want mud tires for my monster truck. My wife wants a new outfit or a new purse. You know, those are wants. Yes. Well, if my roof is leaking and there's water falling on my head, I need, you know, my roof fixed. You know, I want, you know, an accessory for my truck, but I need my roof fixed. So I teach people, focus on needs, not wants. And if you can do that, your business that you start will be less susceptible to the economic cycle, the ups and downs, because people can delay spending on wants forever, but they can't delay spending on needs. You know, they may delay a little bit, but at some level, you know, they need to satisfy their basic needs. And so I tell people, focus on needs, not wants. And then I tell people, you know, to then think about recurrent revenue streams versus recurring or project-based businesses. You know, it's like, boy, if I got a pest control company, I sign a contract with my client, they give me their credit card. First of every month, I bill their credit card. And that's recurring revenue. It's contracted revenue. So I got needs versus wants, focus on needs. I've got cyclicality then. You know, it's like if I'm a project-based business, I build pools, for example. Well, in a bad economy, homeowners aren't building pools. No. You know, so I got no work to do. And so, you know, focus on recurrent revenue, needs versus wants. You know, and then from there, I call it, you know, let's apply what I call is the 30-20-10 rule. So we have to build the perfect small business in order to build a $1 billion empire. I got to start with the perfect small business. I want to make it, break it, or fail in the first $100,000 worth of revenue. We do that by breaking things down to what I call unit level economics. So, you know, if I've got a landscape maintenance company, someone who's out there with a mower and a blower and a weed whacker, and they're cutting grass, cutting lawns all day, yep. My smallest unit level economic is one truck, one crew, you know, and how much revenue can that crew bring in? And what are my costs to service that revenue at the direct operating line? I need to have at least 30% gross profit in my perfect business. Yep. And if I can achieve that, if I don't achieve that, I've got to keep working on that aspect. I got to charge more for the service. I got to lower the cost of providing the service, but I need at least 30% gross margins. Once I've got that, the 20 and the 30-20-10 rule is my SG&A or my back office cost, my cost to acquire customers, to pay myself as an owner, yep, to pay the person answering the phone, you know, working the computers, doing HR, has to be 20% or less, you know, at a minimum. I hope it's lower, but at a maximum, I can't be any more than 20 because I need it. The minimum line, the 30-20-10, I need to make at least a dime on a dollar. And so what I'm doing when I'm focusing early in the book on unit level economics is I'm teaching people how to build an economic formula to get where 97% of this country's small businesses never get, which is the first $1 million in revenue. So in the book, I talk about this mythical landscape maintenance, you know, contracting business. Yep. And I need to have 6 crews in order to get to 1.1 million in revenue. And if I do that, I'm going to generate, you know, about $150,000 in growth or in net profit at the bottom. And so, you know, I go through how to build the economic formula for revenue, how to build a capital expenditure model for the equipment we have to buy, the trucks we have to buy, yep, you know, and I teach them the economic formula to build the perfect $1 million business. And then I expand that to the perfect $10 million business. Now you're into a territory where very few entrepreneurs ever tread. And so from there, I teach them about going from 10 million to 100 million, 100 million to a billion. You know, as you get to the different sizes, when when's the best time to sell? I talk about selling a company as not being a one and done event. When I sell my company, it's a rest stop on a wealth creation highway. I'm going to bring in outside capital. I'm going to become a minority shareholder, and I'm going to keep building my business, you know, and I'm going to keep building it from about 30 million, 40 million in revenue, you know, up to hundreds of millions of revenue using someone else's capital. I'm going to be a minority shareholder. Yep. And I know that freaks a lot of entrepreneurs out, but I give them an example. And the example is simply Jeff Bezos. You know, so at one point, he's arguably the world's richest man. He's not today because Amazon stock's down and he had a divorce. But the world's richest man at the time, you know, owned, you know, 12% of his company, which means somebody else owned 88%, yet he was still the world's richest man. So, you know, we don't have to be the majority shareholder, you know, to build an empire.
No.
We can do just fine, you know, if we're a minority shareholder. So I teach people the different activities and behaviors at the different sizes of company that they're achieving and, you know, teaching them, you know, how to go from zero to a million to 10,
escalate,
10 to 100.
Yeah. I just think that we can only ever possibly scrape the surface of the depth of detail that you must have provided in these wonderful books. And, you know, we could talk for hours, I am sure, about these topics. Now, I wonder if somebody needs and wants to find more out about you and about the books, what's the best process? Where's the best place for them to go?
So I am very active on LinkedIn. You can follow me on LinkedIn, Adam Coffey, C-O-F-F-E-Y. Find me there. I interact with people who read my books from all over the globe all the time. You can go to Amazon, which covers most countries now, and you can type my name and you'll find my books. There's audio books for people who want to listen. There's Kindles for you e-reader fans. There's paperbacks. There's hardcovers. And so you can pick up my books pretty much anywhere books are sold. And you can engage with me on LinkedIn. I have a website. You know, you can go to adamecoffee.com. If you want to attend a seminar, you know, or some of the events that I host, there's a second website, just adamcoffee.com. And so, you know, hey, I try to be helpful to people. My books are cheap. I donate my royalties to charity, and I try to be impactful. I wish somebody would have given me my 3 books 35, 40 years ago when I was starting out on my entrepreneurial journey. Best $10 US you'll ever spend.
Absolutely.
if you buy the free Kindle versions, and you'll know about private equity, about exits, and you'll know how to build a business
properly. So, absolutely. Well, look, I'm a big audio fan. I'll be certainly plugging them in and having a good listen to it myself. Anybody's on this call today, if you want to get your hands on these books, no matter which format that you're interested in, I will be making sure that the links back to Adam and all of his wonderful books are available to you below this post. No matter where you see the interview, you're going to find those links. And Adam, I have really thoroughly enjoyed having you on the show today. So I'd like to say thank you for joining me on the My Future Business Show.
Thank you for having me, Rick.